Welcome to the Pitchfork Review. I am Pooja Patel, the editor of Pitchfork, and I'm here with our associate editor, Anna Gatza.
Hi.
And senior editor, Jill Mapes.
Hey, how's it going?
So today we're going to talk about Taylor Swift's newest album, Folklore. It was a total surprise, announced and released last week with less than a day of advance notice, basically a music critic's nightmare. And Folklore came drenched in this really woodsy aesthetic to signify that this was Taylor Swift's quote-unquote indie album, or at least a break from what she was doing with pop. She revealed that the album featured The National, Bon Iver, and her previous collaborator, Jack Antonoff, and you can really hear all of them. The result is a pared-down version of what you might expect from her. The fact that so many people did work on the album made the secrecy of the rollout that much more impressive. Everyone here at Pitchfork was taken by surprise. It was definitely a very interesting and stressful 24 hours, but I can't say that we were mad about it.
I feel like whenever it's Swift season, whenever Swift is in the news, you can feel this excitement and like full glee. And you can see parts of Pitchfork activate, like which DMs start lighting up and like your switchboard just activates for Taylor Swift. What was your like first feeling upon hearing that this was coming?
So this past Thursday, I opened my eyes at like 9:01 a.m. and at 9:02, I got a Slack DM from our social media staffer, Verinda, who said, "New Taylor." I was like, "What?"
Cool. Jill, what about you?
I was definitely like in bed looking at Twitter, seeing it, and instantly being like, "Are you fucking kidding me?" Like, I just, that's the reaction that music journalists have. Like, the surprise drop is one thing, but the like heads up for the surprise drop, sometimes I really wonder if that's not more infuriating.
Yeah, the surprise album part is the part that induces all the stress.
Yeah. It's not like when it's a proper surprise album, like when Beyonce happened the first time, where it was truly thrilling because it was something new. There's none of that. Like, I know what you mean about the like Swift season. It's like back to school. You're like, I need my sharpened pencils. Like Taylor's got her album or whatever. But like, I was actually a little excited.
Yeah. I think part of the like immediate anxiety, Anna, and then the partial glee, Jill, is like the discourse around a Taylor Swift release cycle is always so elongated and involves like multiple mysteries and fan theories and conspiracies and like a magnifying glass to the album art and so on and so forth. And she kind of cut all of that out this time. Like, we didn't have the chance to overanalyze her intentions on this go. So why do you think she decided to do it this way?
So, you know, usually like Taylor's long album rollouts feel like they're just like designed to keep pulling your attention back in and keep pulling your attention back in. And like, that's not necessary right now when people's lives are maybe a little more limited and they have less going on. Everybody just wants something to look forward to, and nobody can think more than a few days in advance. You know, a surprise album is not a new thing in general, but it is a new thing for her specifically.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like a lot has happened over the last few years with Taylor Swift too. She went from this really distant, kind of fully aestheticized pop star to someone who was really trying to be a vocal ally or an advocate for social justice issues for the first time. Anna, do you have any thoughts on what happened in the last few years? Can you describe that transformation?
So I feel like you have to start with 2018, where she kind of spoke out in support of those Democratic congressional candidates in Tennessee. And this was kind of a big deal because she'd never really voiced a direct political opinion before. And then we learned that she had left Big Machine Records, which is the label that she was with for her entire career to date, and like moved over to Universal and signed a pretty unusual contract that allows her to own the rights to her own master recordings, the original recordings of her work, which is a big get, something that would not be possible for most artists who are less famous than Taylor Swift. And we had then the release of Lover last August, which would be her first album with Universal, her first album that she owned the rights to. And then we had this debacle when Big Machine, the label that owned the rights to her back catalog, was sold, and it was sold to powerful music manager Scooter Braun, known as like Justin Bieber and Kanye West's manager, backed by a group of investors. And that kicked off a public fight with Taylor. And there was this weird blip also a few months ago when Big Machine, now like in under the Scooter Braun administration, released a live recording from 2008, like kind of ancient Taylor history, this old radio recording, and kind of packaged it like it was a new release, sort of. But she said that she wasn't informed about it, and this just kind of made her, got under her skin again.
And I think she was making the specific point that this is just another way that men have been manipulating and controlling her career for her entire life.
I mean, I think another really key event for her was this trial against the radio DJ who was like, it's a civil trial, so he wasn't convicted, but he was like found to have assaulted her by groping her at this old meet and greet back in like 2013 or 2014. I think that really probably was a little bit radicalizing for her in a way. And that's something she sort of alluded to in her documentary film, the Netflix documentary, Miss Americana, as well, was saying that going through that kind of humiliating public experience of having to like sort of litigate your sexual assault in court was something that really affected her.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that's real. Some very real things have happened to her. And to know that it would stretch out for years and years, I mean, you do have to really give her props for standing up to that, you know?
So I think Miss Americana, as a viewer, you see it as a recap of her career because that's what it literally is. But I think from Taylor Swift's perspective, I think Miss Americana was sort of hitting reset, and that she saw it as sort of a fresh start and a fresh, you know, a fresh introduction to who she is as an adult.
So let's dig into Folklore. Swift is like definitely growing up, and she's just like here to be an independent woman and to state her case, but is also apologizing for the first time and feels kind of self-aware in a different way. What song signifies kind of that growth to you?
Last Great American Dynasty is, I think, one of the best Taylor Swift songs ever. Musically, it's really good.
It's very good.
You really can see it play out. And I think a lot of Taylor Swift's best songs are like that. You can imagine it. She's picking up on little bits of very classic American imagery. Rebecca rode up on the afternoon train. It was sunny.
Her salt box house on the coast took a mind off St. Louis. Can you give an example of that?
We're talking about Rebecca Harkness, who married into the Standard Oil family, who is a reviled woman, a mad woman. They wanted to, you know, drive her out of Rhode Island, apparently. And she's going at the end. And I bought her house. And now that's me. So, yeah, I like it.
Yeah, it's great, especially like since it has that actual literal direct tie in to the house that she owns. It is like it's sort of like, I don't know, like a Dave Eggers book or something, where it's like a little bit fictional and a little bit the first person, you know, then the first person walks into the room. Just really, really clever setup and works really well. And something I really like, Jill, that you said in your review is that it sounds like a national song too. And like, I hear that in kind of the way like the little like swells of like piano and synth go, and it just, you can hear that sort of the back line of the song, you can hear happening in a national song.
Oh yeah. I do totally love that. I love that. It's really a nice base for all of these interesting images she's bringing up. And it's like, it's subtle because you don't realize the work it's doing, or at least I don't. I'm so focused on like, Rebecca's on the train and she's looking towards her salt box house. Okay, I'll stop. But yeah, totally, Anna.
But she's like, she's making fun of herself too. Like when she says like, oh, there's only so much like new money can buy. Like certainly Taylor Swift is someone who's been criticized for maybe throwing sort of gauche parties that look very expensive. And yeah, like that's, she can own that.
But wait, let's talk about Mirrorball, which is, I think, a staff fave, a kind of like standout highlight that also shows a lot of growth.
Yeah, I like Mirrorball a lot, too. I say it's maybe growing on me slowly, but the part that interests me and the part that sort of speaks to her growth as a person is the way that that song acknowledges that the way she presents herself has changed and that she can she can change her spots in different situations, kind of copping to like being a people pleaser, which is something that we all do, but something that she's been criticized a lot for as well. I can change it. So like, two lines that really speak to that for me are, one of them is like, I can change everything about me to fit in. Mm-hmm. And the other one that I really like a lot is like, I've never been a natural, all I do is try. I've never been a natural, all I do is try, try, try. I'm still on that track. You know, within, it makes sense within the narrative of the song, but it's also like a commentary on Taylor Swift, who's someone who was like, not necessarily born a super gifted, like, belter singer. She's someone who had to practice and learn and get better.
No, yeah, I really think she is such a, this sounds terrible, but she is like a pop tryhard. She's, and you just know it. You can tell she's not cool. She's not effortless. And that's not her thing. But I think it's why she's gotten so much shit done, to be real with you, and mm-hmm. like changed her sound and gone in so many different ways.
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about her being a little bit of a tryhard, like, listen, I'm not going to lie. When I first heard that this was called Folklore, and I saw the image of her in a black and white barren woods, I thought of Bon Iver, and then lo and behold, there he was on the album. But of course, some of us who have been fans of Taylor forever understand that, you know, this might be a return to some of her kind of like more traditional narrative songwriting or her country roots. So does it land for you? Does her intent get across?
So Folklore is an okay title. She's totally entitled to use it. I guess to me, this is just, it's just simply not a folk album, and it's not folklore either. And like, my association with those words are like Alan Lomax or like some kind of deep study on the etymology of words and cultural stories. And like, it's just simply not that deep. A characteristic of a folk album is that it draws on like sort of an established folk canon, or there might be like melodies or songs that are adapted from songs that are like so old they don't even have an attribution. And there's none of that here, because the only folklore and the only mythology is like Taylor's own self-created in-world mythology. It's a little bit like Harry Potter as compared to like the history of witchcraft.
I think folklore Twitter agrees with you, because I heard last week that they were really mad from my archivist boyfriend, who was like, folklore Twitter, man, they're so pissed. I was looking at some tweets. Oh, man. They want the respect. Honestly, like, they want the folklore respect. Anyway, go ahead.
And like, here's what I think that part of that might be picking up on is like, not just is it a little ahistorical, but folklore has a darkness to it. And you see that in all these nursery rhymes or like children's stories that have like the big bad wolf. Like, that's scary. That's terrifying. It really speaks to like really deep rooted like fears and like darkness in the human experience. And I, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of subtlety on this album, and there's a lot of empathy, but I don't really see that. I don't see fear. I don't see like danger or death or plague or like a lot of the things that are really influential drivers of actual folklore.
Yeah, definitely. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk about some of our least favorite parts of the album.
Hey, I'm journalist Sam Sanders.
I'm poet Saeed Jones.
And I'm producer Zach Stafford. And we are the hosts of a podcast called Vibe Check.
On Vibe Check, we talk about everything. News, culture, and entertainment, and how it all feels.
That's right. We talk about any and everything on our show, from real life issues like grief to music and movie critiques. And that barely scratches the surface.
Yes, indeed. And it doesn't stop there. We have got a lot to say. So join our group chat, Come to Life. Follow and listen to Vibe Check wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, friends. I'm Alamin Abdul-Mahmoud. I'm the host of the new podcast, Commotion. If you don't know about us yet, well, we are your daily deep dive into the biggest stories coming out of the world of pop culture, art, and entertainment. And luckily, I'm not going to be doing it alone, okay? I'll be joined by some brilliant culture writers and thoughtful superfans. We're going to have hilarious hot takes. We're going to have vibrant debates. Consider this your invitation to join the group chat. Get in here and join us. Commotion, available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
In my mind, the worst song on the album is Exile. Okay, won't go that far.
Wow.
It's a really jarring song. And
I'll go that far. I broke it down for you. Let me tell you why it sucks.
By all means, please.
Wow.
So many layers here. I think objectively, Exile is just very slow. It's sort of plodding, which means that every aspect of it is really noticeable. So when the lyrical metaphors are kind of clunky, when the string arrangements get kind of overwrought, you're really hearing it all at a slow walking pace. Also, Justin Vernon's singing, it's like, it's really deep. It's like a real bass singing voice, which is not what we're used to hearing from Justin Vernon anymore, since he's, you know, gone so hard into the vocoder effects. Justin Vernon's like deep singing voice.
It's so deep.
On this Taylor Swift album.
I can see you standing, honey, with his arms around your body.
It's so deep, and it's really, it's just off. It's just, we're not expecting it. It comes out of nowhere, and it comes after. The first three songs on this album are three of my favorite songs. They're all spectacular, a great opening run. And then you just have this, like, left turn. So that really kind of sets it off on the wrong foot. For me, it gets better once Taylor's vocal comes in, which is super weird to me. Like, I like Bon Iver a lot too. I like Justin Vernon and like listen to all his music as well. This is not to hate on him as an artist at all, but I don't think this is the song or the sound that any Bon Iver fan ever wanted to hear. So it sort of feels like it's all in service of Taylor, and it's not even her best song. We've seen a lot of great quarantine collabs in the last few months. It's like the only kind of collaboration we get anymore. And a lot of them are so great. And I'm so impressed. Most of this album, I'm so impressed how much they were able to do like remotely by email. It's like really just like impressive to see artists work together like that. But on Exile, I feel like is an example of where you really hear that the chemistry is not there and that the kind of interaction or like emotion you might have gotten out of a studio experience is really lacking. And like, it sounds like they emailed those files to each other, unfortunately.
It really does. I will say the point for me that it turns around is the first time Justin goes like, step right up.
Yeah, that's
it turns around for me.
And classic.
It totally turns around for me in the end.
So step right up.
What is your like overall takeaway on the album? We gave it an 8.0. We had lots of conversations around where it lands in her discography. Like, how did this land for you? And also, do you think she accomplished the intent of it being kind of her, not return to roots, but like her more intimate, personal, indie album?
I don't think Taylor will make a record like this again. So I think that positing it as her quote unquote indie record is a fair enough assumption at this point in time. You know, I said this in the review and I do strongly feel like it's like a indie homage. It's like, I like indie music too. Now I have cool taste too. And this isn't performative. I really think this is like genuine. So for me, I think that it is, I think it's free time. I really do think of the record as like, it doesn't have to mean anything. It doesn't have to fit into her grand plan of how all of her records are supposed to work or what they're supposed to do in her career, because this whole time wasn't supposed to be how it was. And I don't think it's calculated, because I don't know that she would commit to this and take time off if she knew she had to like tour this record, because it's not a record that would make any kind of show like Taylor Swift's shows, which are generally still sparkly and bright and involving like glittery cat suits and like big sing-alongs and stadiums and stuff. And that's not this music. So for me, I do think it's like a one-time thing.
Where does this album sit then? like in releases from this past year or even the year before, this is not sitting with Chromatica. It's not sitting with Dua Lipa's album. Like, where is this album sitting in the playlist archive?
Indie vibes. It's going to end up on an indie vibes playlist. You know, they can put people on indie playlists that aren't actually indie, and they often do on Spotify. So I could see Taylor ending up on Badass Women of Indie, which I believe is an actual playlist. So I don't know, but I think it's like you listen to it and you know that it is built for more people than the Phoebe Bridgers record. You just right. know it is. That's the game.
Absolutely. Part of what's exciting to me about it, though, is that it's the implications for music that doesn't have anything to do with Taylor Swift, which is like, what if we had a different music industry? What if we had a music industry that didn't demand singles? What if we had a music industry that wasn't controlled by a monopoly power in the radio and the touring and the ticketing businesses? Think if every artist had the kind of flexibility to do this type of sort of passion project that Taylor Swift did in quarantine, like things would be completely different. We're missing out on so much incredible stuff because these types of commercial imperatives and contract restrictions are holding people back from doing things that are more authentic to them and are more spontaneous. And we got a little peek of it here from someone who has the privilege to do that.
Totally. That's a great point.
Yeah, for sure. But I think the fact that it's a little bit too long is a thing we didn't touch on. And I don't know if we're just like...
like, don't be like Taylor and end things where they're supposed to.
I think, Pooja, you should ask it like a whole new question. You'd be like, so one thing we haven't talked about is how this album is like a little bit on the long side. But before I get to that, this is over.
Yes. Yes.
Well, thank you for being a brave soul. Two brave souls, Jill and Anna, both reviewing the Taylor Swift album. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, Pooja.
Thank you. Goodbye.
The Pitchfork Review is hosted by me, Pooja Patel. Thanks to Anna Gatza and Jill Mapes for coming on the episode. You can follow Anna on Twitter at @tweeasfuck and Jill at @jumonsmapes. And I'm at @sonari. You can follow Pitchfork on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at @pitchfork. This episode was produced by Jasmine Aguilera, Caitlin Pierce, and our executive producer, Alex Kappelman, with help from our assistant producers, Ben Montoya and Alex Jerome. Ben also scored the episode. Our original music is by Andrew Epen of Basement Crafts. This episode was mixed by Mark Phillips. Special thanks to Amy Phillips and Julie Shen. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to leave us a review and subscribe to the podcast. Thanks for listening and see you next week.
Hey friends, I'm Alamine Abdul-Mahmoud. I'm the host of the new podcast, Commotion. If you don't know about us yet, well, we are your daily deep dive into the biggest stories coming out of the world of pop culture, art, and entertainment. And luckily, I'm not going to be doing it alone, okay? I'll be joined by some brilliant culture writers and thoughtful superfans. We're going to have hilarious hot takes. We're going to have vibrant debates. Consider this your invitation to join the group chat. Get in here and join us. Commotion, available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.